If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The inhabitants of Sherburn then began shooting out of their windows at the parliamentarians.
Why?
They poured out of their doors shouting, "Kill the roundhead dogs." They attacked them with pikes and muskets, and actually with scythes, with which they attacked the parliamentarians' horses and tried to sort of rip out their bellies in the street.
That was Professor Mark Stoyle describing how Sherborne's royalist townsfolk ambushed parliamentarian cavalrymen in the Civil War. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. See historyextra.com/subscribe-today for subscription deals. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, Google Play and Zinio. For details of these digital formats, head to historyextra.com/digital. Now, before we move on to discuss the Civil War, we have a short advertisement break.
From Sunday Times best-selling author David Gibbons comes a brand new adventure set in ancient Rome, telling an epic story of brotherhood, loyalty and bloodshed against the backdrop of the legendary siege. Destroy Carthage takes readers into a world of extraordinary military tactics and political intrigue that Rome's warriors and citizens used to cheat death. Inspired by Total War Rome 2, from the best-selling Total War PC game series, Destroy Carthage is the first in a brand new series of novels. Out now in hardback and digital from all good bookshops.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
In the summer of 1642, some 7,000 parliamentarians marched against the Dorset town of Sherborne to take what they refer to as the cradle of cavalierism in the west of England back under parliamentarian control. Our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, met Professor Mark Stoyle at Sherborne Old Castle, the site of two Civil War sieges, to find out more about this volatile period in the town's history.
Right, so Mark, we're sitting in the ruins of Sherborne Castle, which were home to the Digby family. Who were the Digbys and who did they support during the Civil War?
Well, there's quite a curious story with the Digby family that before the Civil War actually broke out, it was felt by a number of people that George Digby might actually be a supporter of the Parliament. But in the end, he sort of turned to the King's side, and he was seen by many of his sort of former friends as something of a traitor, really, in the run-up to the Civil War.
Why did he... So he was quite high up in Royalist camp, was he?
Well, he became quite a sort of a close advisor of the King. And as a result, you know, he was sort of feared and distrusted by many of the parliamentarians.
OK, and the castle was besieged on two separate occasions.
That's right.
What was so important about Sherborne and the castle that made the parliamentarians want to take back control?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think that the real importance of Sherborne is that it lies in the heart of quite a Royalist area. And this was one of the first communities really in the southwest of England that actually declared itself for the King and against the Parliament.
Yeah.
And because Parliament at that time was very dominant in this region, this was seen as sort of rebellion against the parliamentary forces, and they were keen to crush it really before this sort of outburst of royalism spread, if you like.
So were they hoping to make maybe an example of Sherborne to other towns that might be the same?
Possibly so, yeah. I think that at this stage, right at the beginning of the Civil War, it looked as if the whole of this part of England was going to come over to Parliament. So obviously they were anxious to make sure there shouldn't be any sort of outbursts of royalism. And I think you're right that they were keen to make sure that here they stamped on royalism quickly before, if you like, the flame of support for the King was able to spread.
How royalist was the town?
Well, it's a hard thing to say, obviously, because looking from this time, you know, back, you know, almost 400 years, it's really hard to be sure about the question of popular allegiances. But all of the evidence suggests that Sherborne was probably one of the most royalist towns in the whole of the south of England. And we've got a number of very clear demonstrations of popular royalism here. We know that large numbers of the local men joined the King's army. Right. So it really does seem to have been a hotbed of support for King Charles.
And he made his western headquarters around this area, didn't he?
Well, Charles himself at this time was up in the north of England and moving down through the Midlands and Wales.
Right.
But he sent a group of his supporters into the West Country in order to try and rally support. And after having failed dismally to do so in Somerset, they retreated across the county border to here in Dorset. And this is where they first began to really manage to raise quite substantial numbers of ordinary men to support them.
And at the time, what was the tide looking like? Who looked like they were going to be? I mean, had war actually broken out?
Well, we're actually looking at this very interesting stage when we're just in the opening, the beginning months of the Civil War.
Right.
The King had just raised his standard at Nottingham just a short time before Sherborne becomes the centre of attention, really, in the southwest. And at this time, there was really very little evidence of other areas of the southwest that seemed to be coming out for the King. So, yes, this was the first headquarters, if you like, of his local supporters in the West, where they actually began to garner a certain measure of popular support.
And Parliament, it didn't do half measures. They sent an army of about 7,000 men
to
the town.
Yeah, a huge force.
What happened?
Well, really, as soon as the parliamentarians initially were quite exultant in having driven the royalist supporters out of Somerset, and I think they thought at that point that perhaps they'd dealt with the emergency in their area. But once they saw the royalists had established themselves here in Sherborne Castle and were getting support from the townsfolk, they thought, well, this is something we've really got to stamp on. So they raised mobilised troops from all over Somerset, Dorset and Devon and brought this huge force all the way to Sherborne to, well, as I say, to stamp on the Royalists as hard as they could.
What were numbers, Royalist numbers, looking like in the castle at the time? Were they all sort of holed up here waiting to be sieged?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously they were hoping not to be sieged, but their numbers were not that great. I mean, you know, probably just a couple of hundred in the castle and a few hundred more in the town with the support of some of the townsfolk. So it's very much, you know, a one, or it seems to be a one-sided battle, a very large parliamentarian force against a very small Royalist one. But the Royalists seem to have had the advantage of perhaps a greater degree of military experience and perhaps some more commitment to their cause. The parliamentarian soldiers, although they were very numerous, they didn't have any sort of military experience, or at least a lot of them didn't.
So Parliament failed to on that attempt?
Yeah, they failed really in quite a humiliating manner. I think one of the problems was they expected the people of Sherborne itself to support them and almost to let them into the town.
Yeah.
But in fact, that didn't happen. So this large parliamentary army was sort of encamped in the fields round about with no shelter and obviously not very nice for them. And then once they actually met the first test of battle and the the Royalist guns began to fire out and they saw one or two casualties beginning to occur, well, actually large numbers of the parliamentary soldiers simply took to their heels and ran away, and as a result of that their commanders were forced to raise the siege.
Is there anything about the position of the castle that helped as well, helped it to withstand the attack?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it's a really strong position. It's not going to be easy to take without large numbers of cannon. And then, as I say, the fact that the town was actually in alliance with the castle meant that whereas the Royalists were, you know, cosy and well-sheltered, they had beds, they had roofs and so forth, the parliamentarian soldiers were actually having to bivouac in the field, not something they enjoyed.
What sort of time of year was that? Was it?
It was in the summer, so perhaps, you know, you might feel that that would have meant it was easier, but I think these were freshwater soldiers and they just weren't used to this sort of thing.
It's all quite new. The second siege, 3 years later, in 1645, was actually led by General Fairfax himself. That was quite a different story, wasn't it?
Absolutely different. I mean, by this stage, we're at the coming towards the end of the Civil War.
Yep.
Both sides have got large numbers of experienced soldiers. So that sense of, you know, novices, if you like, that you had in 1642 doesn't apply anymore. And also, whereas at that time, the parliamentarian force had been sort of scraped together from local levies, untrained, unexperienced, the new model army is a really powerful, formidable force.
Yeah.
And you're talking about, you know, well over 10,000 men camped in this area, and really the Royalists were facing a very tough proposition, and in particular the new model army possesses a very powerful field train of artillery pieces, and it was always likely that they were going to be able to simply blow holes in the walls of Sherborne and take it that way.
Yeah, I'm just looking out now from where we're sitting. You can imagine the thousands of parliamentarians sort of ready to siege the castle. Must have been quite a formidable sight from within.
I think it must have been pretty frightening for them, really. And they also knew that by this time the tide of the war had turned against the king. His own main field army had been defeated at the Battle of Naseby a few months beforehand.
Yeah.
So it must have been pretty frightening for the Royalist defenders. They knew that their side by this time had got the, you know, had lost the upper hand, and they were now up against, you know, the strongest army that England had ever seen.
Do you think it would have made any difference to the outcome of the Civil War if they hadn't been able to take Sherborne that second time?
Well, I think Sherborne was a very powerful irritant to them. And it also possessed, of course, this great symbolic value. Because it was seen as the first centre of royalism in the west of England, the very cradle of cavalierism, as they put it, I think it was particularly important to them to crush this royalist centre of resistance. And of course, once that was done, there were several other advantages to them. It meant that there would be no royalist strongholds between them and London, which meant that they had clear lines of communication. And also, because there was quite a lot of support for the king in this area, the Royalist garrison here was encouraging the local clubmen, who were sort of irregular soldiers that the Parliament was quite worried about at this time. So crushing the Royalist garrison here at Sherborne would also take away the sort of comfort they were offering to the pro-Royalist clubmen too.
Okay. So the clubmen? There was actually a battle, wasn't there, between the parliamentarians and the clubmen? Is that in the town itself?
No, that was actually, at this time, large numbers of ordinary men and some women too rose across the south and west of England complaining against the soldiers of both sides who were plundering and taking their goods. There's been a lot of debate amongst historians about, you know, what the clubmen were really doing. Some people see them as completely neutral, who just hated both sides equally. Others see them as having been, well, essentially against all sorts of soldiers, but having a bit more of a preference towards royalist or parliamentarian, depending on what area they came from. And certainly the clubmen around the Sherborne area do seem to have been infiltrated by royalist agents and to have had at least some leaning towards the king's side. So again, for that reason too, Parliament was quite keen to neutralise Sherborne.
Yeah. I mean, Sherborne, like other towns of the period, you know, you say it was fervently royalist.
Yeah.
What made certain towns decide, you know, that it would come down on one side or the other? What sort of factors would be considered?
Again, that's a really, really interesting question. It's one that I've spent, you know, my career really looking at for years and years. I think there are all sorts of different factors, but to me, at least, I would argue it's a sort of mixture of religious and cultural conservatism. Right. It's areas that are quite resistant to Puritan Reformation, that's to say to sort of godly Protestantism, the most advanced forms of Protestantism. They're much more keen on the sort of traditional service, the Book of Common Prayer, a rather more relaxed and traditional form of Anglicanism, if you like.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they're quite wedded to their traditional customs, the maypoles, the church ales, all the sort of the Merry England kind of things, if you like, and really not at all keen to embrace Puritanism, which they see as almost stamping on their sort of preferred form of religion and culture. And they see the king, I think, as the defender of that kind of English religion and culture, and Parliament as the sort of assailant or attacker of those kind of views.
Right. So it wasn't necessarily Charles himself, it was what he stood for and
exactly.
what he represented.
I would say it is that. I mean, you know, some historians have argued that the influence of the Digbys was important. Obviously, they were the biggest local landowners.
Yeah.
A number of their tenants were nearby. It may well be that they were able to exert a certain degree of influence as well. But no, I think you're right, Charlie. I would agree that it's not so much a sort of a blind loyalty to the king or to the Digbys, and it's much more seeing the king as the protector of the kind of religious and cultural traditions that they respected and admired.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I think sometimes it's easy to see them, to see people affiliating themselves to either side because of particular people, perhaps, or for the king.
Yeah.
But did it sort of come down to put their own, you know, much smaller scale personal lives and what they could get out of it, really?
I think so. I mean, again, the traditional line that would have been, you know, pushed 50 years ago is that ordinary men and women didn't really care. They didn't really understand about the issues. They were told what to do effectively by their social superiors. So if the Digbys had said, turn out for the king, they would all just doff their caps and do it. But I think really the true picture is much more complex. And we can see in a number of areas of the country when pro-royalist or pro-parliamentarian gentry try and raise their tenants, sometimes they absolutely refuse to obey them. They actually chase them out of town in several villages in the West Country. So no, I think it's got a lot more to do with the preferences of ordinary people.
Yeah.
And yes, if the local gentleman takes the same view that they do, they'll be more than happy to turn out in his defence. But if he wants to push them in a way that they're not happy with, there's a lot of evidence of them refusing really to go along that route.
Yeah. And how do events in Sherborne, how are they reflected elsewhere in the country at the time? What was happening for the second siege?
Well, by that time, we've got to the stage that really the king is in a pretty awkward position. He's lost control of big tracts of the south of England and the Midlands, and he's really reduced to his sort of key core areas, if you like, which are Wales and Cornwall, which had always been very strongly royalist. Some parts of the West Country further west from here, Devon, West Dorset, West Somerset, and the area around Oxford, which was, of course, his headquarters and his capital during the Civil War. But certainly in most other areas of the country by this time, that the parliamentarians are dominant.
Yeah. And local, I mean, nearby Dorchester and Lyme Regis, they were quite strongly parliamentarian, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Would men have been raised from those towns to come and siege? So it would have been sort of almost neighbour against neighbouring town against neighbouring town, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very interesting. At the beginning of the Civil War here in Dorset, we have a number of letters written from people in Dorchester, sort of saying, we here in Dorchester are doing all our best for Parliament. We're raising lots of troops and we're bringing in people to assist. But, you know, the malignant townsfolk of Sherborne are, you know, holding out for the king, refusing to do what Parliament tells them. So, yeah, there's a lot of bitterness and local rivalry. Even within an individual county, towns had very sort of different preferences and perspectives, I think.
So it really did rip the country apart, really.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. So counties were divided. And although, as I've said, in some areas there were sort of particular towns, villages, parishes that would go more for one side than the other, there was almost always somebody within an individual parish who wouldn't go along with that. So, yeah, all English communities really are torn apart by the Civil War.
Right. So what actually happened during the siege? How long did the castle hold out?
Well, during the second siege, it didn't hold out for very long. Although the royalists were very determined, you know, they were sort of courageous individuals, it was pretty one-sided. Mm. And as I've said, the parliamentarians had these huge siege pieces and also great superiority in numbers. So, in fact, this second siege lasted for less than 2 weeks in the end before the royalists were sort of, well, forced to surrender after having large parts of the stronghold battered down around their ears.
And was it that ruined, you know, has caused the ruins that we're sitting in today?
Well, not quite, because in fact, what we can see today is really a legacy of the parliamentarians having slighted the castle, which is a term really meaning demolished or razed to the ground. Right. Because Sherborne had been such a centre of royalist resistance to them, and because, to be honest, they had quite a degree of animus against it as a result, soon after the castle was captured, Parliament itself ordered that it should be slighted, rendered indefensible, so it could never again be a centre of royalist resistance to Parliament's cause.
So rather than taking it on themselves and making it a stronghold of parliamentarians, they chose to destroy it completely.
Yeah. And I think, again, that may reflect the fact they knew that it was in a sort of a centre of royalist sympathy. It was really good for them to get rid of it and make sure that it could never be used by the local royalists again.
That's quite a message as well, isn't it, to put out?
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, still today, I think, you know, as we see this sort of tumble of ruins, it still carries a sort of message of Parliament's power and its determination to really sort of dominate this area of local royalist sympathy.
So Charles I in 1649 was executed.
Yes.
What happened to Sherborne after that?
Well, what seems to have happened is that despite the execution of the king, Sherborne, like many other sort of pro-royalist areas, it doesn't just sort of roll under. It remains a sort of centre of disaffection to parliamentarian rule.
Right.
The parliamentarians remain quite anxious about Sherborne, quite apprehensive on it. They keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
And on several occasions when sort of plots and insurrections are planned in the West Country, it's to Sherborne that royalist activists look for support, and it's also to Sherborne that Parliament looks to make sure that nothing untoward does happen there.
Right.
So it's a time of quiet in Sherborne, but a sort of quivering
grumbling,
quiet, if you like.
Yeah, underneath. Yeah,
that's a good word to use, I think. Sort of grumbling resentment, probably. Yeah.
And did Cromwell place any sort of key parliamentarians in the town to keep an eye on things?
Again, I'm not really sure about that. I think that with the castle, if you like, neutralised, it was unlikely that a town, you know, that the townsfolk themselves were going to be able to resist the strength of the new model army. So, no, as far as I know, there was no parliamentary garrison here. I'm not sure about that, but I don't think there was.
Right. So what sort of sources do we have? You've mentioned some quite, in your piece, you mentioned some lovely quotes that parliamentarians have sort of threw against the town.
Yeah.
Where are these coming from? Where do these...
Well, I mean, one of the lovely things about Sherborne's Civil War history is that we do have so many wonderful sort of primary sources. And quite a lot of the material that I've drawn on today is taken from the news pamphlets that were published at the time. And some of these were sort of one-off pamphlets that were just written to tell people about a particular event.
Mm.
So obviously the siege of Sherborne attracted a great deal of attention.
Yeah.
And most of those were printed in London. And there are also regular news pamphlets, what were like almost the first English newspapers or diurnals, which were published on a weekly or a fortnightly basis. And they too had a lot of information about what was going on all over the country and here in Sherborne, as in other places. And there are also several sermons that were preached by parliamentarian ministers. And we've got a particularly good one by an Exeter man called John Bond, who was a fierce Puritan. And it was him who coined this term of Sherborne as the the cradle of cavalierism. And he also called it the first western nest of the cockatrice's eggs, which is a reference to Sherman as like a cradle of Catholicism and popery, where what he saw as the evil sort of eggs of Catholicism had hatched and brought their cavalier brood out upon the land. So yeah, we've got some wonderful sorts.
Very powerful language. They obviously had quite a lot of fear and resentment towards the town.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think there is a sort of sense of bitterness that where Dorset contains very godly towns like Lyme and Dorchester, it also contains, you know, towns like Sherburn and Blandford, which are seen as very pro-royalist and almost as treacherous. And on one particular occasion, when the townsfolk of Sherburn attack a party of parliamentarian horsemen, you know, they are really sort of roasted in the parliamentary press that refers to them as the malignants of Sherburn, you know, the sort of the traitors of Sherburn. So there's a great deal of vitriol in many of these sources, yes.
So between the two sieges, there was an occasion when the Sherburn townspeople turned on parliamentarian forces.
Yes.
What happened there?
Well, this is a particularly interesting story. And again, I think it sort of underscores the royalism of Sherburn. At this stage, it's still in the early part of the Civil War. Mm. Most of this area is secured for Parliament and the castle also. They'd kicked out the royalist garrison by then.
Yeah.
So they felt fairly well in control. But there was a rumour going around that the castle was about to be seized again by royalist sympathisers.
Right.
So a party of parliamentarian cavalrymen were sent to seize the castle. And they arrived outside Sherburn and they made their way right into the heart of the town and asked the townsfolk if they could shelter there for the night. And they were told they could. But as they were coming in, one of them noted a bell ringing out. And they said, they asked one of the townsmen, what's that bell ringing for? And he said, it's just the 8 o'clock bell. But once the parliamentarians arrived at the centre of the town in the marketplace, they were suddenly challenged by a group of armed men who, and when they said, who are you for? They said, we're for the king against the parliament. And at this there was then a sudden flurry of rifle fire, and the inhabitants of Sherburn then began shooting out of their windows at the parliamentarians.
Right.
They poured out of their doors shouting, kill the roundhead dogs. They attacked them with pikes and muskets and actually with scythes with which they attacked the parliamentarians' horses and tried to sort of rip out their bellies in the street. And as a result of this sort of ambush, the parliamentarians were driven out of the town. And they were infuriated by this, of course.
Mm.
And as you can imagine, some of them sort of sought revenge. At the time, some of the parliamentarian soldiers actually set light to the inhabitants' houses. So some of the houses were burnt down. And then within a few days, the parliamentarians raised a large number of soldiers, came back against the town and actually took it and drove the inhabitants or the royalist inhabitants out.
And were there any punishments as a result of that?
Yeah, I mean, because of this act of treachery, as the parliamentarians deemed it, they took quite a severe revenge on the people of Sherburn. We're told that they pillaged all of their houses. They took away as much goods as they could carry. They arrested one or two of the most prominent townsmen. And as they rode out of the town again, taking all their pillage with them, we're told that they actually took down the town bell, which had been rung to raise the town, and took it away with them so it could never be used to raise the townsmen against them again.
Gosh, I mean, that's either a very brave move or a very foolish move on the part of the townsfolk.
Yeah.
What do you think made them do it? Was it pre-planned, or was it just a spur of the moment, you know, all that kind of resentment that's been boiling underneath, you know, simmering over the last few years?
Again, it's a difficult question. I mean, I think you're right, though, that it was quite foolhardy.
Mm.
There aren't many towns in the Civil War, particularly undefended ones like Sherburn, that are sort of brave or foolish enough, you know, to attack soldiers in their midst. So I think it does show, again, the royalism of the town. Whether or not it was pre-planned is hard to say, but the fact that the bell was rung out, the fact there was a group of soldiers waiting, the fact that everyone rushed to their windows, I think it probably had been planned. I think they knew
they had arms as well, didn't they?
Exactly, ready. Their arms were ready. I think they knew the parliamentarians were coming, and they thought, well, this is a relatively small body, perhaps we're strong enough in ourselves to repel them. And of course, you know, they were probably hoping for royalist reinforcement for elsewhere, because at this time the royalists in Oxford were again planning to send troops to Sherburn, hoping to rally local people to the king's cause here again.
But that didn't happen in the end.
Not on that occasion.
No.
Although the people of Sherburn would have been pleased, because just a few months after the ambush and then the punishment which followed, royalist forces did sweep into this area, took control of it again. And it was at that time that they were able to re-establish their garrison here in the castle.
We've mentioned that the period when Cromwell was in charge of the country. When Charles II was restored to the throne, I'm guessing that was a great cause for celebration in the town.
Yeah.
How was it received? What did people do?
Well, we have this wonderful report of what happened here in Sherborne when King Charles II was proclaimed after the restoration of the monarchy. And it really does seem to have been a quite stupendous occasion. We're told that so many people flocked in from the surrounding countryside that they couldn't actually fit into the town.
Gosh.
And they had to stand outside. Yeah. And the townsfolk themselves seem to have celebrated to the max. We're told that the streets were strewn with flowers and with rushes. We're told that the men of the town paraded in arms, and that the maidens of the town, the young unmarried women, they actually trooped through the town, about above 100 of them, almost in sort of military sort of formation. They were led by a woman beating a drum, and all of them wore sort of white celebratory waistcoats. And we're told that this was done to show that, you know, the women of Sherborne could show their loyalty just as well as the young men could. So everybody seems to have got involved. There were bonfires. The fountain at the middle of the town ran with wine. There was bread laid out in the streets, free for everyone to eat. And then at the end of the day, not only was an effigy of Cromwell sort of torn to pieces and then strung up from a gibbet, but they also lit great bonfires on the hills that we can see here around the town. Mm. And we're told that these bonfires could be seen all over neighbouring Dorset and Somerset to show, you know, the elation really of the townsfolk at the restoration of the monarchy. I think it is a kind of celebration of, you know, that they won out against their local enemy.
Eventually.
That was Professor Mark Stoyle of the University of Southampton. Mark's latest book is The Black Legend of Prince Rupert's Dog, Witchcraft and Propaganda During the English Civil War, and that's published by the University of Exeter Press. You can read his feature on Sherborne's role in the Civil War in the September issue of BBC History magazine, which is out now. And also in our September issue, we have articles about Waterloo, medieval letter writing, Edward III, vampire attacks, and the Battle of Flodden. And if you happen to have an iPad, you'll be able to enjoy an interactive version of the Flodden article, featuring a series of maps of the battle and video and audio commentary from historian George Goodwin. You can find the BBC History magazine iPad app at the newsstand. And that's almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we might even read your message out in a future episode. And you can follow us on Twitter @HistoryExtra. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/HistoryExtra. And don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you'll find history news, blogs, image galleries, quizzes, and more. And you'll also get your chance to have your say on some of the hottest historical topics. In next week's podcast, we'll be joined by Tom Holland to talk about his new translation of Herodotus. Plus, a couple of notable historians will be discussing their favourite books with us. Do join us for that. The History Extra Weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.